This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Jason Kelly. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Bloomberg Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show weekdays at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio. All right, let's talk a little bit about where we are in the stock market. I think Carol is entering this segment with a little bit of trepidation because Sandy Villery is here, partner at Villery Funds, looking after about $2 billion. He's based down in New Orleans. We've been talking about the Saints. We've been talking about LSU. We've been talking about University of Georgia. He's going to the SEC Championship this weekend, but we're not going to talk about that. Maybe we'll talk about it a little bit later. We're going to talk about the market. Sandy, great to have you.
Thanks
Sorry. Oh, wait, what?
No. Did you check out? Did you go to your happy place?
I'm actually looking for a Giphy that's got an eye roll so that I can tweet it out.
Oh, good, good. Well, that's
Giphy,
great.
Giphy?
Whatever.
Yeah, okay. So let's talk about investing.
Yeah, so what's the state of the markets here, Sandy? You know, I feel like the theme that's developed on this program over the past couple weeks is, oh man, this feels much better than we did certainly back in September, even with those sort of unpleasant couple days earlier in the week. How do we finish the year?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. We were more, I'd say, Fed-driven. So everything was revolving around, are we going up or down in interest rates? And now that it looks like inflation is comfortably below, you know, their target of 2%, I think that kind of Fed risk or interest rate, you know, possibility of rate hikes or that sort of thing are kind of, you know, there's nothing that's going to happen from that front probably for another 12 months. So now it's all trade war related. So that's what's kind of been moving things recently. And if the trade war, if it causes some headline risk and that sort of thing, we're going to look for our individual stocks to try to find good value. And I do think we, I think these little dips in here are going to be great opportunities before the December 15th trade war deadline. And I think you'll be pleasantly surprised to have a nice Christmas rally.
Let's talk about your fund, the Villery Balanced Fund, beating just about all of its peers so far this year. It's returning nearly 20%, 89th percentile, according to Bloomberg data. What's balance mean right now? What's the right balance strategy in this environment?
Yeah, so in a perfect environment, I guess we'd be about 70% in stocks and 30% in bonds. And we're actually a little bit heavier in cash right now. As the market goes higher and higher,
How much heavier?
Actually, we're about 10% in cash.
That sounds like a lot.
Yeah, for us it is. When we're historically 1-2% in cash. So
wow.
We've recently taken some profits in a few names that have exceeded our expectations.
So have you backed out of more of the fixed income or backed out of more of the equity side because they've done okay?
Yeah, so we're down at about 62% in stocks right now. So we've kind of backed out of that, and then we're kind of at the minimum level on bonds as well. Just thinking that, you know, with rates going as low as they have, maybe there's not much more, you know, left in the bond market either. So
are you, with that high cash position, is it just a case you're waiting for some new equities that kind of catch your attention to invest in, or is it because you think a recession's near?
Basically, we see it as sort of bullets in the gun. And if you think about last year, December of 2018, when the market fell 9.2%, that gave us the opportunity to get two new names to work. And literally between Christmas and New Year's, we were able to buy two more stocks. So we're looking for opportunities and volatility to buy.
So let's talk about some of the names that you like. On Semiconductor is a really interesting one, not one we hear about a ton, but you like it. Why?
Yeah, so we had owned Cypress Semiconductor, and Cypress got bought out by Infineon for literally 15 times
EBITDA. You love that. You love that when
that
happens,
it was a big price.
Yeah.
We were happy, nice premium, and so there wasn't much left in that. And so we switched to ON Semiconductor, and really we think it's a kind of a secret way to play the 5G build-out because they had no exposure, no content at all on 3G or 4G, yet they have $100 of content on each of these base stations that's they've got almost all the suppliers, so they're involved in all of those, and I think that's going to be a nice play for them.
It looks like, though, I'm just looking at our FA page on the Bloomberg, it looks like revenues, though, have been declining quarter to quarter, year over year. Same thing with earnings. So what's the problem here?
What's interesting is if you look at they do have exposure to auto. So they're in Europe. We saw weaker auto numbers. China, we saw weaker auto numbers. The amazing thing is when you look at their peers are down like 9 or 10% because of that. They were only down 2%. So they're doing much better, and it's because of the content story in autos, where each iteration of these electric vehicles or autonomous vehicles, they're getting more and more of their content on each one. So that's what's helping them out.
Talk to me about eHealth. That's another interesting name because I had did an interview earlier today. We're going to play out with the CEO of IAC, and he was talking about getting into the travel business early, sort of early internet, early 2000s. eHealth is sort of trying to do what Expedia and Travelocity were doing, right?
Yeah, no, that's it, and it's amazing. If you compare their website, which eHealth.com, and you compare it to Medicare.com, or you compare it to healthcare, .gov, it's an amazing difference. The government-run website is so clunky. Theirs is extremely slick and a true e-commerce website. Love the demographics. 10,500 people are turning 65 in the U.S. every single day. 60 million seniors are eligible for Medicare, and they just have 1% market share. We're hoping it gets up to 4% market share. So
they sell insurance.
They do.
This is a stock that's up 134% this year, and we're talking about a forward-looking PE of about 41, which is fine if the growth rates justify that. When did you get into this name?
We actually got in within about 30 days ago. We bought it.
How many days?
It was around $58, $59 a share. There was a lot of headlines on
that. It's at 90 now.
It's at 90. It's been a great performer so far.
Right.
But this is kind of my, you know, what I'm saying in terms of use these macro headlines to sort of find individual stories and buy them quickly, because when there was the Medicare for All discussion, this stock got absolutely walloped, as this wouldn't do so well for their business if you didn't have to go purchase healthcare.
When the market gets slammed down, whether it was 3 months ago, whether it was August, is that when you do a bunch of buying?
Yeah, actually we did. So that's what we're hoping to do, and we will continue to take advantage of volatility to buy good stocks.
You want the markets to be beat up a little bit.
a little bit of volatility. Use it as your friend, not your enemy.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Sandy Villery, partner at Villery Funds, based down in New Orleans. Go Tigers, go Saints, and that is spelled GEAUX. Go.
I'm rolling my eyes.
I know.
Me and Taylor Swift. I just put it on Twitter.
Oh, boy. All right.
You must be alive. Smoke gets in your eyes.
So we do want to talk about vaping, already under scrutiny for health risks and deaths. It was linked to a rare type of lung damage in a new case report released just yesterday. Controversy of the safety of e-cigarettes, man, it is raging big time in the U.S., where the deaths of as many as 47 people have been linked to a different severe respiratory illness. The FDA, meantime, has said it does not know when final guidance will be issued when it comes to e-cigarettes. So let's talk about regulations of the e-cigarette market. With us is Dr. Joanna Cohen, professor of disease prevention and director of the Institute for Global Tobacco Control at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Joining us on the phone from Baltimore, we do want to point out that the Bloomberg School of Public Health is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. Michael Bloomberg has also committed $160 million in an effort to ban flavored e-cigarettes and vaping devices. Dr. Cohen, nice to have you with us. This is certainly one of the big issues that the country is grappling with, and I think regulators are as well. You know, what are some of the issues that are front and center when it comes to vaping regulation?
Right. Well, this is a tricky issue, exactly as you say. On one hand, we want to help get cigarette smokers off of cigarettes, because that's the most harmful thing you can do. So the idea of e-cigarettes and the promise of them was to really provide that off-ramp for cigarette smokers. The problem is that instead we've seen a huge uptake of e-cigarette use among kids, and that's exactly not what we want to see. It's turned out to be a public health disaster.
And so what happens next from a regulatory perspective, Dr. Cohen? Because, you know, one of the interesting things, and Carol was alluding to this, it's happened very fast that the government, and I think even public health advocates, have really identified this as a major issue. How do we get sort of smart regulation, but it sounds like in a relatively quick manner, given the speed at which this is all happening?
That's right. So one of the things that's very concerning with the huge increase in use among kids is that the vast majority of them are using flavored e-cigarettes. We also hear that cigarette smokers who are using e-cigarettes to quit also like flavors. So it gets really tricky. How do you get flavors to cigarette smokers who are trying to quit but keep them completely away from the kids? So it does get tricky, and I think that's why the FDA is taking a little bit of time to make sure that they get it right.
So I guess what I'm trying to understand, too, is I feel like we have various conversations where folks say the problems are with, like, black market e-cigarettes. But, I mean, the point that you're making is we obviously don't want these in the hands of children. For smokers who are trying to break the habit, e-cigarettes is a better option. Is that fair? Is that correct?
Well, we still don't have great evidence yet that it really does help cigarette smokers quit, but that was the promise. That's the one reason why we might have e-cigarettes on the market.
What's interesting, too, and I know Bloomberg Businessweek magazine has covered this in depth in terms of how quickly e-cigarettes seem to get to be able to come to market, even though the FDA oversight wasn't necessarily all in place. I mean, how did that happen?
Well, when e-cigarettes first came into the market, the FDA saw them and thought, hey, this is a smoking cessation device and we need to regulate it as other smoking cessation devices. So we certainly have approved nicotine replacement therapy and other pharmaceutical products that have been shown to be effective to help smokers quit. But e-cigarette companies sued and said, we don't want to be regulated like smoking cessation devices. We want to be regulated like tobacco products. And that put a huge delay in the process. Mm-hmm. And it's taken a while for all the administrative pieces to fall into place for the FDA to actually be able to now take action in regulating e-cigarettes like tobacco products.
And so what are the companies saying at this point? Because as you're alluding to, Dr. Cohen, you know, companies have very powerful voices among regulators, among lawmakers. I mean, we've seen that for decades in the case of tobacco. What are they saying and doing that may either help this move along or hinder it?
Well, they certainly have their backs against the wall right now and trying to maintain credibility and trying to maintain as much profits as they can as the regulators are working to also address the public's health and keep kids away from these products. So, you know, on one hand, we hear about one of the major e-cigarette companies taking flavors off the market in this country. But just like we've seen with big tobacco in the past, they still have their flavors on the market in other countries around the world. So, you know, they're just acting where they feel the pressure and not really taking the high road and thinking about the true impacts of their products.
Bottom line, just got about 30 seconds here. Do you think that we just went too fast on this?
They went too fast. We went a little too slow, and we're in a bit of a tragedy right now. Where you know, hopefully now our politicians are going to be more concerned about doing right by the kids than by concerned about votes in the next election, and that we can pull this epidemic under control.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. Dr. Cohen, thank you so much. Joanna Cohen, Professor of Disease Prevention, Director of the Institute for Global Tobacco Control at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Of course, that school is supported by Michael R. Bloomberg, founder of Bloomberg LP and Bloomberg Philanthropies. And as we mentioned earlier, Michael Bloomberg has also committed money to an effort to ban flavored e-cigarettes and vaping devices.
All right, so let's talk a little motorcycles. We have got just the man to do it. Jason Chinnock is here. He is CEO of Ducati North America. And can I just start by saying, we're going to talk about new bikes and stuff like that, but can I just say, this must be like the coolest job in the world.
Unquestionably, it's definitely one of the coolest jobs.
Because you're a motorcycle guy. I mean, you actually started like working behind the counter at a doing motorcycle parts, right?
Yes, I did. In fact, it was something that years ago I was following a different career path, and I made the decision. I said, okay, this is clearly not working out for me, this other way I was going. And so I decided I'm going to follow another passion in life. And I started doing my homework, research, informational interviews with executives in the motorcycling industry. And then I realized, I said, the way for me to really learn this is just to cut my teeth at the beginning, at the very bottom. And so I started off as a parts guy at a motorcycle dealership. I mean, I had an education and I was way overqualified for like what I was doing.
Right.
But I said, this is where I got to learn. And I learned customers. I learned the product. I learned how to work with manufacturers. I mean, like, that was those 4 years were probably the most formative years of my career in terms of setting me for my future.
What's changed about the industry since you've started?
The industry is actually, it's become a little bit smaller than back then. I mean, back then, obviously, back in the early 90s or late 90s, credit was a little looser.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people were getting financed for motorcycles that maybe weren't really in the position where they should be financing motorcycles.
Right.
And so as a result, what we saw is we saw a bit of a shrinking in the industry when the recession hit and credit dried up. But the good thing is for brands like Ducati and where we're at, we really weren't affected by that because we always sold in the premium and we never had predatory lending or questionable credit practices. And so as a result, we gained a tremendous amount of market share when the recession hit. Now, volumes were affected a little bit as well.
Right.
And then as the market came back, not to the same degree as it was before, as it came back, we retained our share, increased our volumes. And so it's been quite positive for us in that regard.
All right, so let's talk about this new lineup 2020. What's different? What can people be looking for?
Well, one of the flagship motorcycles that a lot of people are getting really excited about is a new motorcycle that we have called the Street Fighter.
And it's got a great name.
It is. And it comes from the idea of somebody taking a sport motorcycle like what you would see out on the racetrack, removing the fairings off of it, the bodywork, and putting on a really cool headlight and a handlebar. And that basically takes a very aggressive sport bike and makes it accessible for the street. Except for we've taken it and redone a completely beautiful redesign, and it's built off of the V4 platform and chassis, which is a number one seller last year for us. So there's that product, and that's on one end. And on the other end, we find ourselves into the e-bike world as well.
Well, that's what I'm curious about. Tell us how aggressively you guys are pursuing, and how much your customer wants this.
Well, this is something they launched in Europe last year as a pilot project. And then when I saw it come out, I myself being a mountain biker was like, I want that product, even if it's just to have one for myself. And then we took the last year in taking feedback from our customer base, from our dealer network, and just really to understand and research what that market's like. And it's incredible. It's a very fast growing segment in North America. In Europe, it had actually been going for quite some years. But our customer base is our first audience for this product because it's branded Ducati, but there's also some really unique technologies in the partnership that we have with the company that's making the bikes with us.
So, but what's how well did it sell in Europe? And I know it sounds like you tinkered with it a little bit. The first sales in North America are going to happen in 2020, correct?
Correct.
So what are your anticipation? What kind of a market size is this or market potential?
Well, in terms of market potential, we're actually not looking necessarily at the bicycle business to try and compare us to that. We're looking at the first year for it to be a supplement to what our dealers are selling and also to complement our customers' life. So volumes, honestly, it's not something that we're going to be very aggressive on. We, as a premium brand, I'd rather deliver a good experience, not only with the dealership and the product, but also for the customer and to be able to build it in a much more natural way.
But Jason, why do it then?
Why do it? Because it's a compliment to the brand and also to our dealers. And our customers love this. And in the motorcycling world, a lot of.
I'm glad to see you're doing it because I'm kind of all in on green, but yeah. I'm curious,
it would be impossible for me to claim that we were doing this to be green. It's not that. It's the fact that it's.
Appreciate the honesty.
It's a really interesting technology and product where people can actually enjoy out into the real world. I mean, as an avid mountain biker, I can now ride with people that maybe aren't as skilled as a mountain biker with me and can go for longer. And that's why it's a compliment versus, let's say, a green approach to the idea of bicycling.
Is it a quiet bike?
No more different than a bicycle would be. I mean, really, you have a little whiz of the electric motor, and it's assist.
Yeah.
So it doesn't do the pedaling for you, and it's not like a motorcycle where you throttle it and go.
Right.
You have to put the power in order for it to assist you to go through it.
And so talk to us about your customer, because as you say, it's higher end, so maybe a little more recession proof, but we're constantly talking to CEOs about what they're seeing from their customers in terms of their willingness to spend. The consumer has been unbelievably resilient through this very long bull market. As you know, are you seeing any cracks at all, any caution, any pullback as you talk to customers?
Being through the last recession, I'm always have a bit of cautious optimism, we like to use that term, but we continue to bring out more premium product, and we continue to bring out product that's on the higher end in terms of both price that seems to be more resilient than, let's say, even the more entry-level product in our brand.
Interesting.
So I think the challenge that we see is how do we continue to bring people into motorcycling, and how do we bring them in through the sub-$10,000 motorcycles to help foster new growth and development, because at some point those customers start, our top end customers start to age out. So you have to replenish them. We're not really having that sort of effect like some other brands are that are, let's say, have dominated that the baby boomer generation.
Yeah.
We're less
like Harley.
There are other brands, yes, but we're less affected by that because we have
because you have a younger demo.
That's
on
what
average,
I was curious.
On average, we definitely have a younger demographic, but also being a sport brand, youth, you stimulate this idea of like I want to relive my youth, and so even if you're 44 years old, you want to ride like you're a 25 year old,
right?
And so
for a second, I thought you were saying 44 because I'm 45 was older, but I'm just going to let that slide.
No. That is actually that's our average age for a Ducati motorcyclist.
Interesting.
In North America.
Because that's what I was curious. Who's your typical customer? Like, or, you know, your demographic that's yours?
Well, I mean, it is in that 44 years
mostly
old.
Men?
Mostly men. And actually with the launch of the Scrambler product a couple years ago, we've been able to shift that trend as well. I mean, we had a 95% to 5% ratio, and mostly experienced riders.
Yeah.
Right.
And with us bringing in new product and actually shifting our communications, we're actually opening the world to more women motorcyclists as well.
Very cool stuff.
All right.
Fun.
Great to catch up with you. Congrats on the new line. Jason Chinnick is the CEO of Ducati North America here with us in New York City in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio today. I don't know. I mean, actually, the e-bike is really, I find very interesting. I find that whole movement, you know, people who go on bike tours and things like that, I hear a lot of good things about that segment.
Maybe something in 2020.
There you go. Maybe. We'll see. Ducati's a nice brand.
I know it is. I was just like tweeting at
Matt Miller. He definitely
doesn't
has a Ducati.
I think Matt has a Ducati.
He 100% has a Ducati.
It was stolen in Germany.
So he might be in the market for a new one.
Yes.
Take it easy.
I guess you could say that George Soros and the Soros Fund taking it a little bit easy. It's definitely a different era. This story in the finance section of the magazine this week, hitting newsstands as we speak. Also find it at businessweek.com and at bloomberg.com. Let's get into it because it is about George Soros and his fund. With me is editor Pat Regnier. He's the Bloomberg Businessweek Markets and Finance editor. He's in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio, along with Jill Weber, editor at Bloomberg Businessweek. Jill, this is a great story. We talked with various folks, Kathy Burton among them, who has followed the hedge fund industry, has written a book about the great hedge fund folks. And it's a different time for George Soros. We know that. We've seen that over the last couple of years.
Definitely for Soros, but the story is really about Don Fitzpatrick, who's the chief investment officer of the Soros Fund Management. And what's really been interesting sort of on her watch is, and what the story is about, is the pull away from risk that's really happened there. And with it have come returns and some internal turmoil that's come with those decisions. And Pat had been working with Kathy a little bit on this. Katja Porzynski also on the byline. Pat, what did you and Kathy ultimately come down on when you guys were talking about this story?
Yeah, so this is really a story about a culture shift. If you imagine sort of the mystique around Soros, right? I mean, he's famously the man who broke the Bank of England, and that's just another way.
Mystique. That's the Wall Street, like this guy is like a legend for breaking that.
A billion-dollar bet, right?
Yeah.
On the British pound.
Yeah.
And he wanted to go even bigger from
what I understand. He also made a big bet on U.S. elections and got that wrong in the
and went
the wrong way.
He's not a conservative guy
in the sense of being sheepish with what to do with his money. And so it's like the definition of macro trading. You're making these big moves. That is an interesting and can be an exciting strategy to have when you're talking about your money and your clients who want to take big swings. When you are now running the money in order to support the foundations that you run, and they need cash to do the things that they need to do, that requires that you think about your money a little bit differently. And so Dawn Fitzpatrick, who's come in, she's really been charged with building a money management firm for this new purpose. And that's not always easy for the hedge fund managers who work for her.
Right. Well, tell us about that, because she's actually gone on a bit of a firing spree, correct?
Right. I mean, so she's replaced 13 portfolio managers. Some quit, some got nudged out the door. You know, a lot of the people who left, they've done very well since then in terms of raising money. People out there think that they're good money managers, but she didn't necessarily feel like it was a good fit for the firm, both maybe in terms of their style, but also in terms of the kind of investments they
make. I have to say, what's great about this story, and I love how it kind of kicks off about, you know, kind of a classic Business Week take of just reminding everybody about a podcast that happened where she was on it, right? And she basically said, hey, you want to come work for us?
Yeah.
This podcast was pitching anecdote, for employees.
I think it speaks to, and we talked about this a little bit on our show before, where we're at a moment where the hedge fund industry, it's not the same industry that it has been before. And so for somebody who's running a fund associated with Soros to come on a podcast and basically be like, hey, like if you're interested in applying for a job, like here's a place to apply. I think that really kind of speaks to an industry at a certain moment. And I think it got, you know, in certain hedge fund circles, I think it really speaks to the moment. And it caught a lot of people by surprise and was something that multiple people brought up to us during the writer's reporting on the topic.
Right.
Because it's weird. It's different.
Well, right. Different. Because you think about Soros, like over the last 2, 3, 4 decades. I mean, if you could get a job, everybody wanted a job there. Everybody wanted to be associated with George Soros and managing his money.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, this would have been a like any manager's dream job. You wouldn't have needed to hear about it on a podcast. You might have paid money to get the email address.
to send it to.
And running what is kind of something similar to a university endowment is a different game. Now, one of the things that we talked about internally is running an endowment is actually really interesting business, and there's some legendary pioneering money managers doing that business. So there could be a really interesting future ahead for this firm, but you know, it's very early days and it's a rocky transition right now.
Well, and she doesn't have to do a lot, but she's got to make sure she guarantees that the purpose fund is spending, I think, about $1 billion a year. She's got to cover that.
Basically, you have to keep it flat, right? And like that's not totally easy with that much money that's going out the door, right?
Right. Exactly. You describe that as a simple task, but actually, you know, making sure that you have enough money for an institution to live on is actually one of the harder jobs in money management.
And not lose money in the process.
That's right.
That's what it's all about.
To me, like, everything's kind of a strategy story. How do you transition strategies here? And like, she's in the middle of this little turbulent period, trying to get to the other side of it.
How's she doing so far?
Well, so far, she's behind her long-term benchmark and a little bit closer to what they call her medium-term benchmark. She's been at it for 2.5 years. That's not a lot of time to measure somebody.
All right, yeah, kind of giving her a little bit more time. A great story, no doubt about it. It's in the current issue of the magazine, as I mentioned, on newsstands now, and you can also check it out online. Jill Weber, thank you so much. Editor of Bloomberg Business Week in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio. Pat Regnier, thank you as well. Markets and Finance Center at Bloomberg Business Week.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
It's kind of tough on radio.
Just drive, baby.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
It is time for the Drive to the Close. With us is David Richardson, Executive Director at Impax Asset Management, $20.3 billion in assets under management, joining us in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio on this Thursday. Nice to have you here on Bloomberg Radio. It's, as I said to you, as we get a little kooky around here, it's been quite a jam-packed week, but I feel like we could say that about every week for the last decade. The market trade, obviously a little bit quieter today as we wait for that monthly jobs report. How do you see it? What are the trends that you are watching when it comes to the equity market specifically?
Sure. Our focus has been on the transition to a more sustainable economy and the growth investment opportunities that support that. And there are a lot of areas of the economy that are actually pretty interesting for
investors.
That sounds
pretty positive and pretty upbeat.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, where we're thinking of sustainability is where's the sustainability of returns going to come from in the future? And we think growth and things that have tailwinds in growth are interesting.
Well, it is a sustainability week, and we've been doing certainly a lot of things here at Bloomberg, including a global responsible investing forum. I was involved in it earlier this week. Talk to us about the implications of climate change, because it can be a huge risk for various industries. And I think increasingly because of that, they have to take it into account. How do you see it? How do you play it?
Well, we think that there are both, yes, as you point out, risks and opportunities. And Correct. The risks are thinking that the past is prologue for the future. We definitely see lots of changes being driven by climate change, whether that's changing weather patterns and either drought or like we experience here in New York with Hurricane Sandy and flooding of subways. I mean, both of those are investment opportunities in trying to mitigate that. For climate change, there is an adaptation angle, too.
Well, so when it comes, you know, what's interesting, I want to ask you, David, because I feel like we've been talking about climate change and certainly environmental types of investing for many, many, many years. I do feel like it's becoming a lot more productive, and it's not just kind of a niche or cool thing to do, but there's actually really remarkable returns in doing it. What are the bigger trends that you're following that you think investors should be allocating money to at this point?
So what we think about when we're thinking about climate change is the areas of the economy that are going to be most impacted, and one of those would be in energy. And we see a movement from traditional energy to renewable energy, whether that's wind and solar and storage. Sort of repowering the grid is a big theme that's going to be important for the future.
But we've been talking about that for a while. What's different about it? Because it's interesting, in a day when we've been talking about the Saudi Aramco IPO,
right?
Biggest ever, you know, some have said, I wonder if this is the top of the oil markets for them to be doing this. I mean, the changes from, you know, fuels as we've known them, it's taking longer than everybody anticipated. So what is the energy play? What is the right energy play right now?
Well, we're now seeing the commitment to net zero economies, particularly over in Asia and in Europe. And that is going to be the requirements to do that and get to a net zero emissions economy by 2030 or by 2050 require complete rewiring and repowering. And it's not happening as fast as people would like, but you see the large tech companies committing to renewable energy for 100% of their power. It's driving down costs. Battery storage, I think, is a big theme. It's not yet investable in our view, but it's going to be fairly quickly. The rollout of electric vehicles and electrification of transportation, that's all a movement towards a low carbon economy. And there are some great themes that maybe it's not just the renewable energy, but it's the related technologies.
How do you invest in it in the most productive way today?
By
productive, I mean in terms of generating returns.
Yeah, sure. For the best way to reduce carbon emissions actually is to use less energy. And so energy efficiency is a theme that we've been investing in, whether that's reducing energy demand in residences and mm-hmm. commercial facilities, power, industrial facilities. Those are really interesting. And it's pretty, in some respects, low-tech stuff. But we're also seeing that with climate change and climate risk, there's a lot of opportunity around water because of changing weather patterns. You're seeing drought, and we're seeing the horrific fires in Australia and California. And I think what's interesting is, you know, a year ago there were 20,000 people affected by the fires in California. This year there were 2 million people affected because their power got turned off.
Right.
And that makes it a headline issue that investors are taking notice of. Now you need all the standby generation, because that happened when they, you know, the winemakers were crushing grapes.
Right.
So now they need standby power, and that begets a whole bunch of investment.
Is that where you would allocate money at this point, kind of that standby generation area?
It's been one area that's been quite profitable for us.
And you've liked that. What else? In terms of electric vehicles, how do you see it, David? You know, all of them are making big bets, spending lots of money, and as a result, they're, you know, cutting back on workers because they're kind of getting rid of you know, businesses that they think don't make sense as much. In terms of electric vehicles, how soon before it really is as significant as we kind of talk about it today? You know, like we kind of play it up a lot, and it's obviously coming, but I'm just curious in terms of an investment payoff.
I think
how long?
Well, there's lots of opportunity now. What we've been thinking about is, what are the companies making technology that's going to go in every electric vehicle,
not just the components?
The components, exactly, because there's a lot of new componentry that's required that's different than internal combustion engine vehicles. And those products and companies and services have been doing quite well. I think you're seeing a rollout of a lot of new electric vehicle models by almost every manufacturer, and new manufacturers coming into the fore. China's requiring electrification of their vehicle fleet, and that's driving a lot of innovation and growth.
In terms of metrics for identifying companies that are doing environmentally sustainable initiatives, do we need to get better in terms of being able to, you know, create some transparency when it comes to companies and what they're doing? Just got about 30 seconds.
Sure. I think that, you know, we've had a focus on looking at the revenues that are involved in these environmental markets and looking at that first. But you can also measure some environmental impact, positive environmental impact, whether it's reduction in emissions or generation of renewable energy and things like that.
All right.
Well, popular.
It's a great topic, and I know, like, we've been talking about it a lot, focused on it. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it. David Richardson, he's Executive Director of Impax Asset Management, $20.3 billion in assets under management in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker Studio.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com. You can also listen to our radio show every weekday at 2 p.m. Eastern, only on Bloomberg Radio.